Welcome to the Incomplete Skeptic Sober Wise Guy series. In the Incomplete Skeptic, I work at unmarginalizing marginalized voices. And in this podcast, I interview old timers for the Sober Wise Guy series. Here we're free of mind altering substances, and I focus on people who are sober 30 years or more. In my perspective, to some extent, old timers are sometimes marginalized in recovery circles. I think people sometimes assume that old timers don't need positive reinforcement, or that they've got like big egos and should be therefore summarily dismissed as somehow less important than newcomers in recovery. While arguably newcomers are the lifeblood of the recovery body, I'm totally on that page, but I also suspect that old timers are the backbone. Had it not been for the old timers present in my first meeting some years ago, I think I would have probably left. And, in my opinion, God is a spirit of recovery holding both together in grace. God, as I understand God, might be different than God as you understand God, or even as my guest today understands God. But, that's all a personal thing. The big picture objective of Sober Wise Guy is to share experience, strength, and hope, and present this to the still suffering addict or alcoholic, and or to enlighten or remind listeners about what the recovered life looks like. And today's guest is Mark Hertz. Longtime sobriety, just hit 30 years, right, Mark? Welcome to the Sober Wise Guy.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
Yes or no, are you an addict? I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I am an addict.
Congratulations.
My recovery has been in Narcotics Anonymous for the vast majority of these 30 years. I found recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found people that were doing exactly what I was doing and found a better way to live in Narcotics Anonymous. With that said, my basic text for recovery is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Awesome. What was your drug of choice?
Drug of choice is kind of a funny term. I certainly smoked weed every day, all day long for the totality of my addiction. What got me to treatment 4 times, what caused my hepatitis C and almost my demise was a combination of opioids and cocaine.
Were you injecting?
I was.
Okay. Hep C. I've been cleared of Hep C myself. I had it as well. And best I could figure, it probably came from injecting when I was 16 and a half years old, 15 and a half, I don't know, when I was really young. And I only did it for 2 weeks, but it could have been from boxing, where we cut each other's faces. Yep. And stuff, so I don't really know how it happened.
Did you do the interferon and ribavirin therapy?
I chose not to do that. And my liver was in really good shape. And I was, for a person that had it, I was really very fortunate. But then a few years ago, I did do the pills that were safe and
side effects.
Yeah, yeah. So I got to that just bada bing, bada boom. And they said, I still can't donate blood, but I can go through my life as a normal person now. And so how did you put it together that your Hep C came from the pills? I mean, from the injections, I'm sorry.
I can't say with certainty that it came from injecting. I've got 2 instances where if it did come from injecting, it'd be one of those things. One was one of the first times that I injected, I shared needles. I didn't do that. And I was very careful then for 16 years of active addiction. Towards the end of my addiction, I shared a needle again. So it might've been one of those 2 times. I was checked for hepatitis C. in 1991 when I went to treatment and got clean and it didn't show up. I was checked again 3 or 4 years later and it didn't show up. And it wasn't until I was about 11 years in recovery that I wasn't feeling very good. And a doctor checked and found some elevated liver enzymes and hepatitis C. So it lay dormant for a decade or two, depending on when I contracted the illness, before it got active. And then I did the 48 weeks of interferon, what they call pegylated interferon and ribavirin, which is basically chemotherapy. It was torture, at least for the last half of those 48 weeks. But not only was I blessed with being one of the 11% where the viral load went to zero, but I'm extra blessed with being one of the half of 1% where my body totally threw off the hepatitis. I don't even show the antibodies anymore. It's like I never had it.
Wow. Dang, man.
Yeah.
Well, the universe must need you around for a while. That's all.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm sure you're a marvelous work and a wonder before recovery. And can you talk a little bit about what you were like before you got clean?
Well, so in the field of psychology, it's widely held that we turn into our parents. We get the best and the worst from both of them. My dad was a little bit more grandiose than Donald Trump. and I'm not anti-Trump. I'm just describing his level of grandiosity.
Right.
My mother walked through life with nuclear level sadness. Nothing was ever good enough. Nothing was ever right. Life was terribly unfair. My using years were a demonstration of great grandiosity and dissatisfaction with life. I was married in 1980. I was with her for 19 years. I've got two beautiful adult children from that marriage. She was a normal person, not an addict. She was also a normal person that loved to get high. But she wasn't one of us. And so there was a lot of confusion and a lot of frustration for her and for me. We'd be smoking a joint on the couch and I'd hand her a joint for a fourth or a fifth hit and she'd go, whew. And, and I would continue to smoke and she wouldn't want any more. And I would continue to smoke and she would sense the emotional absence. And she would say something like, this pot is so good. Why do you have to keep smoking? And I would think, this pot is great. Why did she stop? And so there was a lot of mutual confusion. I was married to her for 10 years using. I was married to her for 9 years in recovery before I chose to end that marriage. So 10 years and 9 years, I guess we tortured each other for almost an equal amount of time.
Got it. Yeah, that sounds a little familiar. Different cause for me. So... When you set down the joints, you know, why'd you do that? When you quit smoking, I mean, why'd you eliminate it?
I mean, we were never on the same page when it came, even though she loved getting high, we were never on the same page. Towards the end of my addiction, whether she understood it or not, she certainly subjectively got the emotional disconnect. When she finally caught me with a needle in my arm, then the shit hit the fan.
So the consequences, serious consequences began?
I would say serious consequences probably started way before then, but the material stuff that we all recognize pretty easily certainly started when... around that time. She was threatening divorce. I would swear I would stop. I went to treatment. I went to meetings. I kept going. She kept busting me. One of the parts of the story I tell when I get an opportunity to tell my story, what is that by the end of that tour, I was sitting in my office one day, and some people came to see me, and it was a guy to serve me with divorce papers. And it was another guy to serve me with an order of protection. I couldn't go within 500 feet of my wife or kids. And he also had a summary judgment from an official in the county saying that I couldn't access our joint bank account. And I was so sick, involved in my addiction, that I thanked them all very much and went into the office and closed the door and celebrated. That was good news to me. I had a credit card. I could get a motel. I could use the way I wanted to use. And in spite of the fact that I was saying that I love my wife, I love my kids, they're the most important thing in my world. As someone learns en route to being a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, which I'm not, but I do know that anybody on that tour is made to memorize a definition of addiction that says that addiction is a pathological relationship with chemicals and events that take precedence over all other relationships. And so my relationship with drugs had become more important than any of my other relationships or anything else. And I would put my kids' emotional and physical well-being in jeopardy to get high. Mm-hmm. And I could tell you 15 stories about that, but mm-hmm. that's the case.
I don't want to get off your story, but it did make me think of one example that I've talked to DWI offenders for about 30 years now myself. And
I did the same thing for Ramsey County.
Right on, man. You know, that is a group of marginalized individuals, in my opinion, that really need a lot of love.
Yeah, and there were a lot of them in Ramsey County over a period of 14 years that were sentenced to 12 Tuesdays with me.
And hopefully they celebrated it rather than, you know, like they got grateful rather than just stare at the floor. And
you know, some did and some didn't. Yeah. I will tell you that one of my best friends in the world, a guy by the name of Phil, he's a sponsee of mine, although at this point he's got 18 years clean. We kind of sponsor each other. He came through that. He was sentenced after multiple DUIs. He looked at the floor and looked at his watch and bolted out the door as soon as it was over. And 5 years later, I came out of the room and he was standing in the hall and he said, "You remember me?" And I said, "I remember your face, not your name." He said, "My name's Phil and my story turned into yours. What do I do? And I started sponsoring him at that point. It was about 18 years ago. And so, you know, it reached him.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, man. You know, it's all divine timing, or call it what you will. I'm convinced that, love is a solution to pretty much everything. And it really seems overly simplified, but I think most truths are simple. But I always found it really ironic that, you know, if you love someone, you won't hurt them. But if you're an addict, you hurt them anyway. Or if you're an alcoholic, for that matter, and driving under the influence. And, you know, it's like a person would throw their life away to protect someone they love, with one exception, feeding the thing that'll kill their family or their loved ones or themselves or other people. And it's like, you know, the number one killer, for example, kids that die in drunk driving tragedies in this country, it used to be the case, I think the stat still stands, is the number one killer is the parents that love their children, you know, the most. No one loves and they're the number one killers.
And families can love their children to death.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah. Trying to save someone from hitting their bottom, I think, has killed a lot of people, as ironic as that might sound.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I learned, I went to Al-Anon for about 12 years in the middle of my recovery. I have a sister-in-law who's been in and out of treatment and jail a number of times. She's in treatment again right now. Her father, my father-in-law, George, lost one child to his addiction. And he died about 10 or 12 years ago. Before that, that adult child died, George tried everything, and he tried it both ways. He sent him to treatment over and over again. He got him out of trouble over and over again. And at one point, he totally detached from him and said, in his Greek accent, do not call me, do not try to see me, do not darken my door until you are clean and sober. And a few weeks after that, he died. George will never stop blaming himself for that. But the fact is that it was up to him. It was up to the kid. I know plenty of kids that were enabled over and over and over and over again and finally got clean. I know kids who were enabled over and over and over again who overdosed and died. I know kids who were made to sleep under a bridge, who crawled out from under that bridge into an AA meeting and made it, and kids who died under the bridge. And we are truly, as family members, powerless over their addiction.
You know, you mentioned NA, and I've only been to a few of those meetings myself. I went to treatment once when I was a young person, and I wasn't anywhere near ready to sober up or quit going to prison. I'd rather do time than trust somebody to tell them, you know, what was really going on with me. And, you know, some years later, I did sober up, and I did it in program for alcoholism. But I don't see really a whole bunch of difference between any of the programs. There's common themes that work for me. But yet I've met a number of people that say they're not comfortable in the alcoholic circles per se. And I know there's people in the alcoholic circles that are discriminating against addicts, and it makes no sense to me. You know, the big book has a chapter, Dr. Alcoholic Addict. I mean, which part of this is hard to understand, you know? But you have gravitated toward Narcotics Anonymous. And if you could sum up the entire NA package in a few words, what would it be?
Well, the NA package for me, and the difference between AA and NA, and I was never comfortable in AA, because as people were relating their own experience, I had to translate a lot of that. And I felt like a little bit like an outsider, a little bit like a fraud. I walked into an NA meeting and felt at home. The main difference is the same 12 steps, it's the same process. But the main difference for me, as I stated before, is that's where I found people who were doing exactly what I was doing and found a better way to live.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the steps. I trust you mean the 12 steps.
That's the
steps. Yeah. Do they work? And if so, why?
You know, they work for me. I know plenty of people that would say that they didn't work for them. I was in the field for 12 years. I worked with a lot of men who said, I hate the 12 steps. I hate AA. I hate NA. I hate the whole God thing. It's not for me. For most of those individuals, it boiled down to, I don't want to stop using. Mm-hmm. And AA represents not drinking. NA represents not using. And that seems to be the bottom line. I believe, which means I can't prove this, I might be full of shit. I believe that the 12 steps work. If we go back to that definition, addiction is a pathological relationship with chemicals and events that take precedence over all other relationships. Now, I'm gonna go on a little bit of a rant here, and there's no original material in this field. I stole this from a guy named Russell, who stole it from a couple of guys named Joe and Charlie. but it's a relationship problem. I have a sick relationship with drugs and alcohol that are causing me living problems. The steps build relationships. with God, self, and others. So if you look at the steps, if you internalize step one, which really boils down to feeling sufficiently screwed, I don't want to drop an F-bomb. and step one, if you do feel sufficiently screwed and you open yourself up to the steps, steps two and three introduce us to a relationship with God. Steps four and five introduce us to a new relationship with self. Six and seven will get us ready for the interpersonal world. Eight and nine start mending the relationships we screwed up. Not a small part because of our addiction. And if we work the shit out of the first nine steps, we're ready for intimacy. And we get intimacy with self in 10, continue to take personal inventory, with God in 11, saw through prayer and meditation, and with the world in general in 12. So really what we're doing, working the steps really hard, is replacing the sick relationship with chemicals, with healthy relationships with God, self, and others. That fills the void we were trying to fill with chemicals. So that's my spiel on why the steps work.
You know, you touched on something. Well, I'll just say for the audience, I will post the 12 steps. I mean, you could easily look them up. All you have to do is do a browser search. But I will post them and make sure you have access to them. And I'm pretty sure that Narcotics Anonymous has their steps up on their website, so you could find it easily. But I'll make that available to you guys. So, but sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Were you going to say something?
Only that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding on those first three steps. And I think that AA and NA and the treatment industry, and I'll call it an industry, not a field, perpetrate something that can be very, very harmful. When they tell us that step one is something that we're going to have to work on internalizing for the rest of our lives, I call bullshit. I don't think you have to learn step one. I think you have to experience step one. The same way, if you got to be somewhere at 8 o'clock and it's 10 to late and it's a 10-minute drive and your car won't start, and you try jumping it and you exhaust your ability to fix a car, and now it's after 8 o'clock and the car still won't start, it washes over you. You get that response. You can feel all the way down into your legs and you think, I'm fucked. Oops, sorry. that's step one. It's a feeling that you're screwed. When a human being feels sufficiently screwed, I think we're subjectively driven to go outside of ourselves for an answer. There's very few human beings in that situation that would curl up in their back seat and die. What they do is they go outside of themselves. I'm going to walk down to Jimmy's house. He's got tools and knowledge beyond mine. I'm going to call Goober at the Sinclair station. I'm going to call AAA. I'm a member. We go outside of ourselves for an answer. And when we turn our car over to that power outside of ourselves, we've worked step three.
Great metaphor. I love it. Yeah. What's your general take? I mean, you just kind of touched on it, but the treatment, or I'm going to call it an industry. You know, what's your perspective on the industry of treatment?
So I was in the field for a number of years. I am not a clinician, but I had clinicians in my practice. I'm retired 2 years. My practice lives on, my staff now owns and operates that practice. We did intervention, and we worked with families after the initially identified person went to treatment. We worked with the whole family, including that addict or alcoholic when they got out of treatment. That family piece was our passion. But in referring clients to treatment providers, I discovered a number of things. One of the first things, this is a real problem in the field, is the field, the industry, has become market-driven rather than clinically driven. And so just about any treatment provider, and there's a big one here in our area that is a great example of this, when somebody refers somebody to treatment, there's an understanding that they will be referred back for aftercare. And so put yourself in a counselor's position. Somebody gets delivered to treatment on a Saturday or Sunday, and you come in Monday morning and you're looking at the chart, and their aftercare has already been dictated by marketing before you ever even get to lay eyes on them. That creates a rift within the organization between marketing and the clinical team that has really taken a toll.
Wow.
And it also ends up with people being a continuing care program being written that might not be the most appropriate for them, but there's some understanding or obligation to refer them a certain way.
Well put. When I was doing time in prison, I was kind of upset with staff that, you know, they would do something that I thought was morally reprehensible from a 1 to 10. It could be just a 2 or a 3, or it could be a 8, 9, or even a 10, because people were dying occasionally and being allowed to be raped or what have you. And it wasn't a safe environment. And, you know, I tried to call him on it and said, well, we're just doing my job, man. You know, and I can't tell you how many times people would just resort back to that. It's not a job. I mean, if you're in the industry as a marketer, what a way to distract everybody from what needs to be done. You know, I think that's why we get stuck in these models that, you know, they, I don't know, self-replicating. It's like they're one big money amoeba or something. And
yeah. Well, there are a couple of states in the country where this has taken a really evil twist. And I'm sure you're familiar with what happened down in Florida with what they call patient brokering. There was a task force, insurance got tired of paying exorbitant fees for outpatient treatment and people being tested for drugs in their urine every day at very high prices. And those insurance companies filed a suit that led to the Palm Beach task force, which started busting people in Florida. And I had a client who was 18 years old, a female. The family called me because she was lost in that system down there. So she would be in a sober house with very little boundaries and rules, and she would relapse, and the sober house would take her to a detox center, and the detox center would pay that sober house for putting her in a bed, and then a treatment center would pay the detox center for delivering her to them, and then a halfway house would pay the treatment center a referral fee for bringing her to them. And then she'd go to a sober house, and then she'd relapse and start all over again. And they had lost track of her. They could not find their 18-year-old daughter. She'd been through treatment and detox and treatment and halfway house and sober house over and over and over again for 2 years, and they couldn't find her. And she was an adult. She was 18 years old. And I called a private detective in Palm Beach County. And it took him 40 minutes to find her because he was so familiar with what was going on down there.
Wow.
And she had been brokered from one provider to another for 2 years.
It reminds me of a pimp.
That's exactly what it is. And in California, they get around what we see as patient brokering. The front end staff of almost every treatment provider in the state of California is not an employee of that treatment provider. They're independent contractors. And as independent contractors, you're allowed to pay them for every bed that they fill. And it's the industry is sick.
That's really sad, you know. I mean, we can shift things. I'm not sure what's going to take. You know, what do you think would solve it?
As long as we're going to call this a disease and supposedly live under that medical model, it needs the same regulation and the same oversight as any other hospital, any other doctor, and that doesn't exist. Just about any treatment provider, any big treatment provider in the country, if you would call them today and say, my name is Timothy, and I'm an alcoholic and I need treatment, they would say, well, you're going to have to go through an assessment process to see if insurance will pay for this. And if you say, oh, I don't have insurance, but I got deep pockets, and I'm going to self-fund, I'm going to pay cash for treatment, they all say, okay, come on in, we'll treat you. Now, if this really is a disease and we're going to operate under that medical model, can you imagine a heart surgeon? You call and you say, I think I need heart surgery. And they say, well, there's an assessment. There's got to be some tests to see if you're appropriate for heart surgery. And then we'll turn that into insurance. And you say, oh, no, I don't have insurance. I'll pay cash. No heart surgeon is going to say, okay, come on in. I'll crack your chest open. And so we're calling it a disease, but we're not acting like physicians.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds to me like the term disease is just a little piece of the problem. What's your opinion about the disease concept?
Let's remember that the disease concept for what they now call substance use disorder, which I hate that term, the disease concept came about in the 1950s to get treatment covered by insurance. That's a good thing. But I'm not sure it meets the criteria for disease as disease is defined in all of the medical journals. It does meet the criteria for condition. It's chronic, it's progressive, it can be fatal. But we don't call bipolar disorder a disease, we call it a condition. We don't call schizophrenia a disease, we call it a condition. And if this is truly a brain disorder like they're telling us, I think we'd be better served by calling it a condition rather than a disease.
Yeah, you know, I've always had more questions about that concept when I hear it, because it doesn't seem to meet every situation adequately, you know. So I would tend to concur with you on that one. In Al-Anon, they make an example that, you know, the person, we wouldn't judge a person that had a heart disease. Why do we judge a person that has a disease of alcoholism? You know, I understand trying to remove, you know, the blocks to getting well, and to removing the judgment and the attachment to trying to control it and the like, however you want to do that. But it doesn't seem to match the reality of it all, you know, because you bring in controversy with the idea of disease, and there's probably a way to do that without making it a disease question. Just maybe another example would be a guy that, like you mentioned, someone earlier who was kicking himself because he said, don't darken my doorway unless. Well, there's a fellow that had an AA who had a sponsee who wouldn't do a thing he said ever, except for one thing. He would call him, but he'd call him from detox. He'd call him from jail. He'd call him from treatment, whatever it was. And finally, the sponsor just said, you know, you're not doing anything I say. Basically told him he's a piece of crap, you know, and it's the way I'm interpreting it. So don't ever call me again. You're not willing to work the program. You don't take my advice, blah, blah, blah. And as he sat there repeating all these things that I took as an addiction to judgment, you know, which is at the core of many of our problems, in my opinion. He sat there as a quite obese person. And I thought, you know, if you were laying on a sidewalk having a heart attack, and someone that knew you came by and said, well, you know, if you're having a heart attack, you shouldn't have ate all those hamburgers, screw you, and they walk away, you know? And how can we justify dismissing or loving someone just because of the word disease? And it seems to be so irrelevant.
90% of the sober houses out there will kick you out if you relapse. So if this is really a disease, what they're doing is saying, oh, you're sick again? Get out of here.
I did manage a sober house for a while, and I had some, you know, people that were relapsing over and over, and kept bringing them back. You know, I would never kick them out. I just wouldn't do it. You know, I didn't own the sober house, but I wouldn't kick them out. They are exactly the ones that we are there for, you know, and I just didn't have it in my heart to send them packing, you know.
I did some consulting work for a local sober house many, many years ago. And one of the things we did was we developed a plan of action for a relapse. And the client would sign that plan of action. And a lot of times his parents, who were funding the sober house, would sign that plan of action, even if he was 22 or 3 or 4 or 5 years old. And the plan of action, you know, said, basically, if you relapse, here's what we're going to do. Where's your insurance? Where are you covered? Where are you going to go to get better so that you can come back?
Well, it's hard to hit a target you don't have. So, you know,
it is.
And being a wandering generality probably isn't going to last long.
You know, I think we have to, we really have to separate who we are from what we do to get a good look at this condition. I don't like the term substance use disorder because it starts, I believe, stealing personal responsibility from recovery. No, we are not responsible for our disease. We're not responsible for our condition. We are not responsible for whatever it is, and we still can't define that. The DSM doesn't even do it. But we are responsible for our actions. And once we've got a few days or a few weeks in sobriety, it is a matter of choice to pick up again. People say that I'm having cravings. And I say, how long since you kicked? And they'll say 3 weeks. And I'll say, those aren't cravings. That's the mental obsession. That's what working the steps is going to lift. And I think that even the industry and the 12-step recovery community oftentimes confuses cravings with mental obsession to the detriment of the individual.
Just a heads up, some of the things you're saying in this interview, I'm stealing a few of those things, and I'm going to use them.
You're welcome to them. There's no original material left.
I hear you. I know this is off topic, but my girlfriend has a good friend, and we've been together like 11 years now, so this is probably 10 years or more ago, and she was visiting, and I was trying to, you know, I wanted this person to like me, you know, because it's one of my girlfriend's best friends. And, you know, I wasn't being outright manipulative, but that was in my head. You know, I want to be friendly and make a good impression, you know, and I started, she had brought up a topic that just really lit me up. And I started chiming in quotes that I'd heard through the years. And in the middle of the third quote or something, you know, my girlfriend just stopped me and she says, oh my God, have you ever had an original thought? You know? And I thought about that without any offense. And I said, well, occasionally, but when I do, I hold it highly suspect, you know. And most of the reasons that I've stayed sober had something to do with what other people have
absolutely
said. That's in so front of me. That's my foundation, you know.
So, you know, back to the comparing it to other diseases, mm-hmm. the behaviors that go with active addiction, the lying, the cheating, the stealing, the behaviors that go with active addiction for a lot of us certainly make it look like a moral dilemma, especially the people that love us. But it's not the only disease that makes us an asshole. I have a very good friend who had cancer and had a lot of his neck muscle removed in order to get rid of the throat cancer. And he couldn't play ball anymore, and he couldn't hold his head straight, and he turned into an asshole over it. But I'd like to compare addiction to diabetes in terms of how people react, because it can sound a lot the same. So if a person has diabetes and is drinking milkshakes and living on sugary foods and French fries, and his family's going to get concerned. His family's going to start saying, you've got to change the way you eat. You got to change your lifestyle. You got to start exercising. You got to start doing this and that. The other person says, no, I'm all right. I know what I'm doing. And the diabetes keeps getting worse and worse. And the family starts begging that person to get the help they need. And the person keeps rebuffing those attempts. And it starts to look a lot like the dynamics of the addict. And if that individual gets chronic in his diabetes and passes out driving, has a seizure and hits a telephone pole, they rush him to the hospital and they discover his acute diabetes and they check him in and they start teaching him a different way to live and a different way to eat. They start teaching him new lifestyles. But in the course of that, he had some gangrene and they had to cut off a couple of toes. So he was in rehab for 3 months and they were teaching him how to walk again. And he finally gets out of treatment and he returns to living on ice cream and candy bars and blueberry pie. He gets sick again. And nobody says treatment didn't work. Mm. They all say, dumb bastard didn't follow the aftercare plan. And I think that treatment doesn't work is fed by those behaviors that so often go along with active addiction, because that really does make it look like a moral dilemma. And lying and cheating and stealing is a moral dilemma and doesn't have anything to do with the condition of addiction.
Why do you think some people relapse? Even though they've got all that good information in their head, you know, or whatever.
You know, look, I'm a 12-step recovery guy, and I know it's not the only way. Even Bill Wilson said we don't have a monopoly on alcoholism. What we've got is something that works for people who've tried everything else. And the field has gone a lot of different directions, and modern psychiatry looks at the 12-step recovery community as folk medicine. There's a lot of machinations going on about that. And I forget your original question.
Why do you think some people relapse?
Oh, people in the 12-step recovery community, people that I've worked with, people that are my peers in the 12-step recovery community, just about to the person relapse because they quit taking their medicine. They quit doing their aftercare program. They quit on what was recommended that worked for them. Nobody works a perfect program. Nobody works a perfect program. Some people have reservations about service work. Some people have reservations about prayer and meditation. The one reservation we're not allowed in the 12-step recovery program is not working the steps. Mm-hmm. And just about everybody I know, now keep in mind, my world is the 12-step recovery community. Just about everybody I know quit working the steps.
Amen. You know, you mentioned medication and you did it as a metaphor, but let's talk about the literal medications. And I've worked in harm reduction for Catholic charities, several, chronic inebriants, harm reduction communities, and some people would look at me and shake their head when they find out I'm there and said it was useless. And I just thought, no, it is not useless. It's a wonderful thing.
There is
a place, what's your take?
There's a place for harm reduction in our society. There is certainly a place for harm reduction. There are some people who will never recover, and reducing the amount of crime, reducing the chance that they're going to overdose and die, those are good things, and there is a place for harm reduction. What's going on in the field right now turns my stomach. The methadone program and Suboxone, buprenorphine, are being called the gold standard for opioid treatment. They're being called the gold standard for opioid treatment because the evidence-based research says there's less relapse, less crime committed, and less deaths from overdose if you're in the methadone program. Those things are all true, but you'd get the exact same results if you dosed them with heroin. As long as they followed the plan, they'd get the same results if they came in once a day for their shot of heroin. They wouldn't relapse. They would not have to commit crimes, and they wouldn't overdose. The problem with the evidence-based research behind buprenorphine and methadone is that the only thing that puts you in the relapse column is the use of another opioid. So if you're in the methadone program and you come in and you piss dirty for heroin or Dilaudid or Vicodin or whatever, then you go in the relapse column. But if you piss dirty for methamphetamine or benzodiazepine, you're still in the recovery column. So that evidence research-based research is skewed. If methadone is the gold standard for treatment for opioid addiction, why aren't there clinics out there dosing alcoholics with alcohol? Methadone.
Wow, the clarity is amazing.
Methadone is just nuclear-powered heroin.
I got to be honest, some of these ideas never crossed my little brain, you know, and I've been around a while.
I'm sure your brain is not little, and for some reason, they're not occurring to the majority of the treatment industry either.
Right. I've never heard some of this before. Some it crossed my mind, you know, it's like I'm, you know, I worked on the medication cart, and you can't help but ask questions, you know. It's like, well, this guy has taken Suboxone, and I kind of wondered why it didn't seem to be.
Well, Suboxone, buprenorphine, could have been a game changer. It was formulated for detox. It was formulated for 5-day to 2-3 week period to get somebody off of heroin without getting desperately dope sick. And used that way, it could be a real game changer for the industry. But it quickly morphed into, well, you can be on it for life. It's just medicine. You're sick, and here's your medicine. You can be on it for life. The same way that methadone was originally a way to get off heroin, turned into harm reduction, come to the clinic every day for the rest of your life. And harm reduction has a place, and it certainly improves the lifestyle of a countless number of people. But there's even more people who have been cheated out of the recovery experience because they've bought into the medicine. Mm-hmm. When I got clean in 1991, if a person came into a treatment facility today with 3 previous treatments and the kind of opioid habit that I had and being almost dead, they would certainly be immediately put into a medically assisted treatment. And I just thank God that wasn't around when I got clean.
Yeah, I remember one guy in particular, of course, we'd never mention names. He had been on Suboxone for years, and he had been back into a facility I used to work at quite a few times And his, you know, drug tests always came back dirty. And they said, well, of course, he's, you know, taking Suboxone. I'm pretty sure that was the one that was making it look like his drug tests were coming back dirty. But it's, I always wondered, well, if it's, why couldn't he be doing something else? And they're going to just dismiss the whole thing because of that.
Well, and you can tell the difference. It depends on how many panels that drug test has.
Yeah, we were just five panels, and I think they had a more complex one that would do something different, but it was a lot more expensive, and they didn't want them used as often.
Years ago, I had a family from Chicago call me, concerned about their son, who was close to 30 years old, and he was living in New York in a sober house on Suboxone, and he'd been on Suboxone for 7 years. And he kept relapsing on methamphetamine, buying methamphetamine on the street. He kept relapsing on benzodiazepine. He kept relapsing, using cocaine, and but he wasn't using any other opioids, so he didn't violate the methadone or the Suboxone program. And he wasn't going anywhere in life. I mean, he was falling asleep with French fries in his mouth. And his family was concerned about him. And I went out to New York and I met with him. He signed consent for release of information for me to talk to his psychiatrist. Now, this is a board certified addiction psychiatrist. And I talked to him and I said, doctor, his family would like for him to be off of Suboxone. And he's expressed an interest in trying to be off Suboxone. And the psychiatrist said, why would he want to do that? Why would he ever want to get off Suboxone? And I said, well, right now he's got no quality of life. He's got no job. He's got no ambition. He's got no drive. He falls asleep in the middle of eating. He's robbing the halfway house for medication. He's been busted. He's not going anywhere in life. And he'd like to try something new. And he said, okay, I'll draw him down and we'll get him down to about 3 milligrams and then take him off. And I said, doctor, after 7 years, do you know how sick he's going to be when he goes to zero? And he said, no. He said, I'll draw him down. And I said, doctor, opioid dependence and being what we call dope sick is not dose dependent. It's time dependent. You can do a shit ton of heroin for 2 weeks and walk away and not be dope sick. You can do a tiny bit of heroin for 3 months and you're going to kick. And opioid dependence is time dependent, not dose dependent. And he said, where would you get information like that? That's against everything that I've learned as a board certified addiction psychiatrist. And I said, doctor, I can assure you, I've done my own research.
Mm-hmm. You have to. You have to have a free enough mind to do
that.
Well,
I know from my own experience shooting dope that it's time dependent, not dose dependent, on if I'm going to have to get dope sick when I stop. But as a board certified addiction psychiatrist, he had no concept of that.
That needs to be out there. Because that makes so much sense to me. And I'm not educated. Who am I to say who's going to even hear me if I repeat what you said? But, you know, I'm taking that to heart. And I think there's some circles I could repeat it.
Well,
I'm going to be listening to this whole interview again and taking notes. So,
Timothy, there's even truth to that with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
A normal person can drink a shit ton of alcohol for a week and not get the shakes and not go through withdrawal. But that same normal person can drink a little bit of alcohol for 15 years. He's going to withdraw when he stops. And so it's very evident with opioids and a little less evident with alcohol, but the concept still holds.
Didn't Bill W. and the early guys used to bring alcohol to the... alcoholics.
There are VA hospitals that still do that. There are VA hospitals that when they get a patient in who's going to go through serious withdrawals, We'll bring them a beer or two every 6 hours for their first couple of weeks there to get them down to acceptable levels. It's on their chart.
Yeah. Perfect. I've went out and bought bottles for people before, you know, small bottles, but I still got it for them because I can see
When I was doing interventions, I was getting on airplanes with people who were starting to sweat and shake. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'd be 3-hour flights. And I'd order them a drink.
Keep them from dying.
Yeah.
Possibly, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I had an interventionist that worked for me, an old guy by the name of Lowell. And he kept him, he was 40 years sober. He kept a bottle of vodka under his seat to transport alcoholics to treatment.
Illegal, but perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I want to bring up a topic of guilt. You know, I used to suffer from an extreme sense of guilt for driving under the influence, killing someone. And that was a long process to get beyond that. But many people in recovery, after they sober up, they feel just a shit ton of grief over their past behaviors, family, friends, to themselves, consequences. How do you get past that?
First, let me put on the table that guilt and shame are two different things.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And the cliche that everybody lives by is guilt is about what you did and shame is about who you are. But I would like to throw a different twist on that. Shame serves a purpose in the world. Mm-hmm. Without a sense of shame, we'd have a pretty shitty place to live. Guilt serves a purpose for humankind. Without a sense of guilt, this would be a much different world. Mm-hmm. And so guilt and shame are not necessarily bad things, but they can become toxic. And if an individual carries that guilt and shame into their recovery, at the very best, they're never going to really be as happy as they can be. And at the very worst, they're going to drink over.
Mm-hmm.
So there's got to be a way to overcome that sense that either we did some really bad things or that we are somehow a really bad person. I was in the field and I had clinicians working for me. I am not a big fan of traditional therapy, where a person swims in his own shit for several years without any real change going on. I've been brainwashed and it needed a good scrubbing. I'm not being disdainful when I say I've been brainwashed. I think working the shit out of the 12 steps, really, really diving in and working hard over and over and over again has been how I've overcome a lot of the guilt and a lot of the shame in my life, particularly steps 8 and 9. Because in steps 8 and 9, I had to work up a level of forgiveness for other people that had certainly screwed me a lot harder than I'd ever screwed them, but I still had to go sweep my side of the street.
Mm-hmm.
And in learning how to muster up that forgiveness for other people, I learned some self-forgiveness.
Same here. It's part of the glue that holds my recovery together even today, you know. It's like without the offense, there is no forgiveness. And, you know, it's related to what you said about shame. You know, it serves a purpose.
In Al-Anon, we go a step further than that. We say without judgment, there's no need for forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
When an individual is driven to forgive somebody, it's confirmation that they've judged that person.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And, you know, I don't know if I'm saying the same thing as you here, but I think I got to a point in my life where I just thought there's nothing left to forgive people for. I'm not offended in the first place. And, You know, it's not that I'm saying things are right, but I just don't get into that comparative mind stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So much in the duality arguments, I suppose, come into it. But like Ernie Larson said, pain becomes power when you hold it up to grace. What do you think of that concept?
I think it's genius. How do you hold it up in the middle of it? I mean, even Gandhi wouldn't celebrate in the middle of a shitstorm and say, "Oh wow, I'm really going to grow for this, grow from this." And it's very, very difficult to do. I got a call from a young man from my home group this morning, pissed off at his in-laws, saying, "I know I'm supposed to pray for them, but how do I do that? I don't feel like praying for them. If I'm going to pray for them, my prayer would be that they go to heaven soon." you know, and we talked about it. And I shared with him something somebody taught me a very, very long time ago, way before recovery. And I was working for this guy and I was having a serious case of road rage. And I came into work that day and I was pissed off about this asshole on the highway. And he said, "You know, the funny thing is he's probably at work, not even thinking about you. And here you are still suffering." He said, "So the next time that happens, picture something nice happening to the guy that cut you off. Picture his car filling up with flowers and his laughing and looking around in amazement as the roses or tulips or whatever grow around him in his car." He said, "And it may sound stupid, but the mind can only do one thing at a time. And if you're picturing something nice happening to that guy, you're not hating him."
Mm-hmm. Amen.
And, that is the easiest route to hold pain up to grace is, mm-hmm. is to have a little fun and even make light of it. I've got a t-shirt that says, "You were offended. I thought it was funny. I'm going to live longer."
I would buy one of those t-shirts. Do it. Yeah. I'll even post it on the, just get her done.
No, I had that one made along with my shirt that says, "Nietzsche is dead, God."
I thought that which kills us also makes us stronger. You know, and he didn't believe in the afterlife. Now he does. And even if there is or isn't one, I don't know for a fact, but I kind of suspect it. You know, when I was going through what is known as the dark night of the soul, I did this while I was in recovery. And it was the 3.5 year period to where the first 2.5 years I wanted to kill myself every day, all day. It was kind of like you were smoking pot every day, all day, except for I was smoking this desire to smoke myself, you know. Kill myself, but I didn't drink, I didn't drug over it or anything like that. And the reason I didn't kill myself, I consider not killing myself my superpower, you know, because I didn't do it. But it was the third step is I had turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand God, and it wasn't mine to take. So I'm so grateful that got locked in. But also I knew that if I killed myself, when someone was going through someday, and I could imagine it might be the case, what I was going through at that moment, if I didn't go through it when they needed me, I couldn't be there. And I wanted to, you know, let people know that there is life after grief, you know. And the last year I only wanted to kill myself, you know, a few times a day. And I felt like that was like standing on top of a mountain in comparison, you know, celebrating. And at the end of 3.5 years, those feelings had shifted. And I don't regret one moment of it. It wasn't easy. I turned it over and I got to see the beauty in pain and the different levels of pain and et cetera. I mean, it, you know, simple not easy doesn't even come close to, you know, what that was like. But I call it my superpower, and it's loving, I don't know, I guess just being in love with everything that I'm going through equally. Mm-hmm. If it feels good or if it doesn't, being unoffendable and unoffensive to the best of my ability. And I offend people occasionally. I'm still an asshole. But the asshole that I am today, it doesn't look anything like the asshole I was before I sobered up. It's like one percent of, you know what I mean? Because it just, the definitions change. But that's a long-winded way of saying, what do you think your superpower is? If you have one.
I guess to make light of things, I think there's a lot of power in humor. I think there's a lot of power in not taking anything too seriously. And that's a real challenge for me right now, especially politically. But I can still make light of it. And I feel better when I make light of it.
Right on. Yeah, I'm not real fond of it either, as most people aren't. I think it's a really challenging time in so many of our lives. But I remember when I first came into recovery, and they said these things were outside issues, and that was a lifesaver for me. Right. You know, I came in as someone who's on parole. You know, I had a lot of work in front of me. And if people wouldn't have loved me as I was and allowed those things to be outside issues and love me anyway, I don't know how I would have stayed sober, you know? So their grace fed a part of me that I didn't know needed to be fed.
Yep.
And until I woke up, you know, and it took me 8 years before I even did a fifth step because I had no trust, you know, and I had done a lot I've had a lot done to me, and I've done a lot to people. And I finally did a fifth step with Mary Jo Robinson, rest in peace, lady. And
Mary Jo.
Yep. She was my sponsor for some years. She got me involved with Mothers Against Drunk Driving and doing ninth step work and et cetera, you know, but the hard lessons were lifesavers for me. It just took a while.
I hate to do this. I truly do, because I'm enjoying chatting with you, and hopefully you and I can meet face to face someday and maybe continue this. I've got a wife, two dogs, and an 11-year-old that are now waiting for me to pop out of this this podcast. I committed to
Very good. Yeah, we did run over.
So I've got some time constraints here, but I've really enjoyed chatting with you, and I'd love to get a cup of coffee someday and continue this.
Awesome. What would you leave the audience with?
Don't lose hope. No matter what it is that you or somebody you love is going through, they could pop out the other side. Especially for the families. My passion in my years in the field was in family recovery. And I would say, don't lose hope.
Very good. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our show. If you've never experienced it before, and if you have, welcome back. I'm really glad that we had this chat with Mark. I'm quite inspired, sir. I appreciate your time. Sorry that we went over, but I was so into it. I just kept going.
Yeah, I would have continued to go, but I've got some other commitments.
All right. Peace out, man.
All right. Love you. All right.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Timothy.
My privilege.